A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on January 6, 2002, entitled, The Best is Yet to Be. The texts for the sermon are Isaiah 60, verses 1 through 7, Revelation 21, verses 1 through 4 and 22 through 27, and Matthew 2, verses 1 through 12. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
First Lord's Day of a new year, a piece whose author I know not, he appeared some years ago in the New York Times, entitled The Big Certainties. The silence has come, the winter quiet that leaves so much room for the cawing of a crow, the twittering of a chickadee, the hoot of the barred owl, the whisper of the wind. No frogs thump the darkness now. No cricket or katydid scratches the night. Short days lie upon the land, and the countryman has a chance to see the dimensions of the world and to try to understand his own place in it. And now it becomes clear that out where there are trees and grass and elbow room, it isn't the little pleasures that make life worth living. It is rather the big certainties, the knowledge that no matter how cold or bitter the winter, there will be violets again. No matter how fanged the winter wind may be, songbirds will return and days will be gentle. That no matter how tightly locked in ice the brook may be by year's end, by May it will leap and chatter and sing of summer. It is the certainty that spring will follow winter and summer will follow spring. Maybe we need to learn these things anew each year. Perhaps we need to face the snowstorm and feel the frost underfoot to know that there are both ice and fire in the earth, even as in the stars, to know that the big assurances endure. On this Epiphany Sunday, I want to make a bold declaration that the best is yet to be. The best is yet to be in terms of the cosmic journey and the human story. Obviously, that is an affirmation of faith which is beyond verification. And yet it is an expression of the trust that we have as a people of faith, as the people of God. It is possible in any given present moment to be paralyzed by the darkness. It is possible in this present situation in which we find ourselves as a nation to be paralyzed by the shock of September 11. In your insert, I had printed a piece from the New York Times from October by David Kennedy, which when I read it, I thought was good to give me perspective, and I thought it might give all of us perspective. It's a piece that I will not read, but simply refer to, where he makes a point that the nation was very jittery, very uncertain, full of fear and trepidation in the wake of that shock. And then he goes on to remind us that we have been there before, that the darkness has been there before, that the fear and the uncertainty has been there before. He points, first of all, to Pearl Harbor to remind us of those days, and yet, as I thought about that, I realized that one really has to be on Social Security in order to remember that. So there are a couple of generations who would not be able to refer back to the anxiety, the angst of those days. But to be reminded that in those days, There were German U-2 boats off our Atlantic coast sinking our shipping. That provocateurs were landed in Florida and New York. That on the West Coast they were so fearful of a Japanese invasion that they cut off radio signals. They moved the Rose Bowl from Pasadena to the Carolinas. And with one of the dark blotches on our history, Japanese American people were incarcerated out of fear and suspicion. And then he goes on to remind us of those Civil War days and revolutionary days, and the fact that there has been darkness before. There has been fear and uncertainty before. And he concludes with a positive statement about the resilience and the creativity of the people of this nation. And I thought on the first Sunday of a new year, on Epiphany Sunday, that it might be good to be reminded that the darkness has always been with us, but that the Epiphany theme, the light has dawned upon you, the light has visited you, is a word that we might well meditate on and contemplate as we try to put our present experience in perspective. For there has been darkness, and the announcement of the light is not a denial of the darkness, not a denial of the harshness, the brutality, the violence, and so much horror that has marked the human story. No, the announcement of the light is a statement in face of all of that, in spite of all of that. It is a statement of faith. It is an expression of hope. It is grounded in a deep trust. In John's Gospel, as he tells the Christmas story, we have those famous words of the Word becoming flesh. And in that context, he says, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has never overcome it. And so this morning, I want to weave a little biblical thread, a little biblical tapestry for you, which is witness to that constant confidence of the people of God in the light that has shined and will never be extinguished. In the Advent series, I didn't use the famous words of Isaiah 9:2, but we did read them in the late service on Christmas Eve, and you'll recognize them immediately. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. That was the 8th century Isaiah. He's also the one in the 11th chapter who spoke about the shoot from the branch of David who would come to judge with justice and equity and who would bring about that state of things where the lion and the lamb would lie down together. And there was 2nd Isaiah who picked up those themes. He's now in the exile situation in Babylon where the people of Judah had lost their faith and had tended to move toward the gods of the Babylonians. After all, they were the victors. And that prophet began with the words made famous by Handel, comfort ye, my people, says your God. Say to the cities of Judah, behold your God. And he is the one who spoke about the return and all of the glory and brilliance and brightness of those passages. The people did return, but it wasn't all so bright and glorious. And so, third, Isaiah, in the context of those first wave of refugees returned, had to encourage them again. He said, arise and shine, for your light has come. The glory of the Lord is shown upon you. And he makes reference then to the nations coming to Jerusalem, the wealth of the nations being brought into the city, and the kings of the nations bringing their gifts, from which, of course, Matthew borrowed a picture in order to tell the story of Jesus. For after third Isaiah and his encouraging words, there was a period of drought and darkness, frankly. And then Jesus is born. And the impact of Jesus causes gospels to be written. And Matthew, in telling his story, goes back to Isaiah. And he uses that word from that name from Isaiah, Emmanuel, God with us. And he borrows the picture of the kings bringing the wealth of the nations. And he tells about the Magi who followed the star, who came to adore and to offer their gifts. And that was written, you have to understand, after Good Friday. So he was aware of the fact that the darkness had come on with its unnerving power. And that darkest of all afternoons when the Son of God was crucified. But it was post-Easter, you see, when those Gospels were written. And the post-Easter church was convinced that the one who was crucified was not dead at all. For they experienced his presence and his power and his life throbbing within their life. And so when they told his story, they told the story of the kings coming with their gifts and the star bright with light, because they believed in that vision which they borrowed from 3rd Isaiah and 2nd Isaiah and 1st Isaiah, that hope of Israel that had come to expression in many ways and forms through many prophetic voices. And then, of course, when the persecution set in on that little Jesus movement, there was one John who was exiled for his faith to the Isle of Patmos. And on the Lord's Day, in the Spirit, he received a vision of the New Jerusalem. And once again, speaking about Emmanuel, God with us, God with God's people, and borrowing from Isaiah 60, he speaks about the holy city glorified, and the gates of the city always open, and the temple there, and no night there, for the Lord God was the light of the city, and the kings of the earth brought their wealth. So you have a whole tapestry, a biblical tapestry, from the Hebrew Scriptures through the Gospels, through that picture of the consummation of all things. And running through it all is that wonderful assurance that the light has dawned and the darkness would never overcome the light. What do you think? Is it just wishful thinking? Every time a historical epoch was entered into with hope and light was announced, it seemed to come to nothing. Oh, those prophetic voices gave hope to God's people. And that's no little thing. The people of God were encouraged, and they were lifted in their spirit, and they did go on. And as a matter of fact, The dream never died. And that's not without its significance. But I wonder, is it just wishful thinking? Is it what it ought to be? What the best of the human imagination wishes and imagines it could be? But finally, is the old world just keep grinding on its way by power and might, greedily acquiring wealth and seeking preeminence? It's interesting, isn't it, that the dream was always dreamed by an insignificant ragtag remnant of people. Can you imagine the chutzpah, the audacity of that dream as it came to expression from Isaiah? Who were these people anyway? They saw themselves as living at the navel of the earth. Goodness sakes, all of the nations were going to come. They were going to flow into Jerusalem. There's a prophetic theme we speak of as the exaltation of Mount Zion. Mount Zion would be lifted up, and all of the nations would flow to her, and she would teach Torah. She would teach God's law, God's truth. And in that prophetic vision, as beautiful as it is, there is talk of righteousness and of justice and of peace. There is a portrait of human well-being, human community, but it's always dreamed by those who have not a prayer of affecting it or implementing it. And old Isaiah in the 8th century was wrong. And second Isaiah was simply wrong. And third Isaiah was wrong. And Matthew was wrong. And the revelation of John was wrong. In terms of history having entered into some ultimate point where the light would flood and scatter the darkness. And we're 2 millennia beyond that. So the dream has been alive for nearly 3 millennia. It's always been dreamed by a ragtag remnant of folk who may well be right, but have not the power to make it right. How could they keep dreaming it? Well, they believed in God. They believed in a God beyond the stars who at some point would intervene and would affect what had been promised. They believed in a sovereign Lord of history that would bring all things to its consummation. And if I were to preach to you this morning the way I preached for many, many years, and the way I suppose these passages are preached in 99 and 44, 100% of the Christian pulpits of the world, then what I would say to you is wait. Hold on. Keep on hoping. Keep on praying. For though the times move on and the reality never comes to realization, nonetheless, trust God, it will be so. Let us pray. I can't do that anymore. I don't want to be just one more voice saying one more time all of those same old things and send you forth saying it was good to be there. Nice sermon. Because you see, I don't believe that some God beyond the stars is going to come in and fix it for us. Is it just wishful thinking then? Is there really nothing to it then? No, I want to say to you this morning that I believe in the message of Epiphany more than ever I have in my life. I believe that Jesus is the light of the world more strongly than ever I have in my life. I preached all these things in traditional fashion and believed them, but I never believed them strongly enough because I never felt existentially gripped by the fact that, my God, Jesus is the light of the world. And the difference now is that I come to see that the light having dawned upon us, it is incumbent upon us to make the light come to its realization in human well-being. I realize now how true it is that the light has dawned upon us. We have seen the heart of God in the face of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ has mirrored God. Jesus Christ has mirrored a God crucified. Jesus Christ has mirrored a God who wins by losing. Jesus Christ has shown us the way. But we have not followed it. We do not need more light. We really know. And one of the blessings of the tradition of which we're a part, rooted in the Hebrew prophets and the Greek philosophers and Roman law, Western civilization, one of the great blessings of this grand tradition is that we have come to see that which allows the human spirit to flower and to flourish. And we know that which constitutes human well-being. But the problem is that those who have dreamed the dream have never been able to implement it because they've been the ragtag remnant of humanity, a minority report always, a voice crying in the wilderness. How could the dream possibly keep alive? Well, as I said, they believed in God, but more than that, the dream is true. It touches the deepest reaches of the human soul. It's true. We know it's true. The new creation, where there's not a child that will die in infancy or an old person die without the fulfillment of years, where people will plant gardens and eat the produce thereof and build houses and be able to dwell in them, a land where they'll not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain. We know that's true. If only a superpower, believed the dream. a superpower, for example, that had amassed power and was willing to yield it up, had amassed immense military might and was willing to lay down its arms, had amassed vast economic resources and would use those to turn the earth into a garden. Then that dream would not be so fantastic. Then that dream would not be so unrealistic. Then it might be possible to effect the dream and to implement the vision. You see, the dream is true. The dream didn't tumble out of heaven somewhere. The dream was placed by the Creator Spirit in the depths of the human heart. And the dream has lived on through all the darkness, because finally that dream will never be defeated. Finally, that dream will continue to obtrude itself upon human consciousness until finally, somewhere, sometime, some people make it happen. And in the meantime, to live in the light of that dream. In the meantime, to have our own behavior affected by that dream. In the meantime, to be the carriers of that light and that life. One could grow cynical. One could despair. Suddenly the war on terror takes second place to the war on the economy. For the son learns from his father that it's the economy, stupid. And so all of the engines of power will be turned on in order to regenerate this monster that we've created, which is not our servant, but of which we are slaves. One could wonder if it can ever be, and yet the dream won't die. And there have always been a minority of people who have believed that the best is yet to be. A people who have kept the dream alive, who've refused to quit, have refused to be silent. Maybe in the long run, if we really want to take the long-range view, maybe a million years from now, they'll look back on us and say, you know what? That was the childhood of our species. Maybe it takes millennia. But whatever it takes, we dare not deny the dream. For the light has dawned upon us, and we are people of the light. And to live in the light is to live even in the darkness, humanely, and to know the mantle of God's grace. Is it just wishful thinking? Or is it time for us to do something about it?